good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us Major Doug Rocky. And Major Rocky was assigned by the military to clean up the American tanks and armored personnel carrier that had been hit by friendly fire during the first Gulf War. And of course, the friendly fire was with the depleted uranium shells that were able to pierce the tanks. And of course, when the depleted uranium shells do hit a tank, why they burn, uranium oxide is produced. And so there is certainly nuclear or radiological contamination of the tanks. You don't want to put people into those, so they had to clean them up. So I'm going to let Major Rocky tell you what happened to him and to the men who worked with him. About how many men were in your unit, Major?
Well, when you look at the Department of Defense actual report, there's a little over 300 people involved in the total cleanup and recovery operations following Gulf War I.
Okay, and now, were you the commanding officer of that unit or what?
No, I was a health physicist assigned as a team on the DU assessment team.
Okay.
My responsibility was to develop, recommend all medical care for the individuals who are initially exposed, and develop the cleanup procedures and disposal procedures.
So what did you determine then? How long, first of all, were you involved in this effort to clean up the vehicles?
Well, right after the completion of the ground war, I got the assignment, came on down from Schwarzkopf's chief of staff down to the theater medical commander, and then they assigned me to do it. So at the completion of the ground war, and then we finished it in June of 1991, so about 3 months.
Okay, fine. And were you able to clean up the tanks and the armored personnel carriers adequately?
No, we weren't. What we did is we basically did what we could, and we buried a lot in country at a place called KKMC, King Klug Military City. And then we also shipped 24 vehicles back to the United States. That was 15 Abrams tanks and 9 Bradley fighting vehicles. It took over 3 years to clean those up for proper disposal at the Defense Consolidation Facility in Barnwell, South Carolina. That's a U.S. Department of Energy site.
Well, by proper disposal, you mean, were they actually put back in service, or did they have to be destroyed?
Well, some were completely, some were put back into service after they were totally decontaminated. Well, not totally decontaminated, because I found contamination on vehicles some years later. But, yeah, some were put back in the service, those could be repaired. Majority of them were just buried.
So you actually just buried the tanks because they couldn't be made serviceable again. Now, how much radiation was in the tanks after they'd been hit?
Well, you have to look at it. The DU kinetic energy penetrator, which was what we used and shot up our tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles, and again, also the Abrams tanks were fully loaded with the DU munitions. Each round, for a 120-millimeter round, is over 10 pounds of solid uranium. So when you shoot it 4 or 5 times, that's 50 pounds being hit, and then you got another 80 to 90 to 100 rounds, another 1,000 pounds. And so it's pretty extensive. We know that the DU round itself emits it between around 300 millirems per hour within 4 to 6 inches. That's beta gamma. And then the alpha contamination is extensive, thousands to millions of counts per minute.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Major Rocky, because he was on the front lines of trying to clean up the depleted uranium, and what he found out was there was no way to clean up the depleted uranium, and today we are simply destroying crack. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Certainly we know that after the Second World War, we dropped nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We also know, of course, that there was no need to do that. The Japanese have been trying to surrender for a matter of about 6 months, and we would not let them surrender. The fact is verified in an article we have from the Chicago Tribune that was written the same day that the treaty was signed on the battleship Missouri and the harbor there at Tokyo. And also, of course, General Wedemeyer told me the Japanese had been trying to surrender, and we wouldn't let them surrender. So, there was terrible nuclear contamination of certainly of Japan after the Second World War, but after the Gulf War, after the first Gulf War, there must have been tremendous contamination of the area there around where the battles were fought as well, wasn't there?
Well, absolutely, because we used approximately 375 tons of solid radioactive materials that were then dispersed in and around the whole area. The Highway of Death, all different areas within Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait were totally contaminated. And after we wrote all our reports and came back in 1992, was specifically tasked, came on down from the Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, through the generals in the Army to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Research Lab, where we were doing work on trying to make sure the military complied with NEPA. We wrote a theater cleanup plan, and that was a no-bid contract that was then awarded to Halliburton, Kellogg Brown and Root, Dick Cheney's company, to clean up the mess within Kuwait and in Saudi Arabia. But they just basically pushed it into a hole. The Highway of Death in Iraq was still contaminated at the beginning of Gulf War II, and it still is. And we just left all the contamination throughout Iraq, so it's pretty extensive. We did the same thing, extensive contamination in the Balkans in 94 and 95, again in 99, and then in Afghanistan here, you know, with all the stuff that started in 2001. So there's extensive contamination all over.
A lot of people are confused by the term depleted uranium. After all, if it's depleted, why should we worry about if it's depleted? But could you explain what the term depleted uranium really refers to?
Well, yeah, depleted uranium is just strictly a scientific term, but it's been used in another, as an adjective, and or an adverb, whatever you want to call it. And what it means is the fissionable component, a small portion of the total fissionable isotopes that are in the solid amount of uranium been removed. For example, when we go into the enrichment process at Paducah, Kentucky, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, at Portsmouth, Ohio, that's near Cincinnati, and what happens is, say, for
everyone... We're going to have to hold that thought because we're going to bring the other stations right on. I really want our listeners to hear your explanation of what depleted uranium is. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Major Doug Rocky, and he is going to explain to us what the term depleted uranium refers to. Words have a tremendous meaning, and when you talk of something referring to depleted, you think, well, that was a problem, but it's no longer a problem because it's depleted, the problem is gone. But that really isn't what it is. When they mine uranium, they mine primarily uranium-238, but contained within that is some uranium-235, and, well, I'm going to let Doug tell you because he's the expert on it, and I'm just sort of an observer. So what is depleted uranium, and why should we be concerned about it?
Well, we have the pure uranium that's going in the enrichment process. So for every 100 pounds of pure uranium that goes in, you have 99.2 pounds is uranium-238. You have 0.7 pounds is uranium-235, and 0.1 pounds uranium-234. And what happens during the enrichment process, we're able to remove 0.6 pounds of the fissionable isotopes for every 100 pounds. Okay? Remove 0.6 pounds for every 100 pounds that goes in. And that's the fissionable isotopes that are used then to make nuclear weapons and nuclear reactor fuel.
That's the process known as enrichment of uranium, is right?
That is correct. And what we're getting is the fissionable isotopes out in a very small proportion. So it takes a tremendous amount of material in order to get a substantial quantity of fissionable isotopes that we can use for reactor fuel and bombs. Because remember, for every 100 pounds that's going in, you only get 0.6 pounds coming out that's usable. It's fissionable. The remainder is uranium-238, but it still contains uranium-234 and 235. And we know, which has been totally acknowledged by the U.S. Department of Energy, that when they use this in the reactor vessels, we get cross-contamination of plutonium, neptunium, and americium, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And so we have a toxic mess. Now, when they say depleted, what it means is we removed 0.6 pounds of fissionable isotopes from the mixture. That's it. And actually, your alpha component, which is what really has horrible effects inside the body, is not been changed, and proportionally, it's actually increased. And for the amount that you have, and then you still have the beta and gamma. So we have all of these beta and gamma isotopes. We have the daughter byproducts. We have the original 238 with the alpha emitter, and that emits an alpha particle at 4.16 million electron volts. 4.16 million electron volts. The intercellular voltage is 10 electron volts. Boy, you talk about a zap when it hits it. It just destroys the cells. And that's what we know that's happened, and that's always been known from day one. So what we have with depleted uranium is nothing's depleted about it other than we've removed 0.6 pounds of fissionable isotope from the mixture. And we still have everything in there. Now, that is then processed through, and it's uranium hexafluoride processed through to create the kinetic energy penetrators. It's processed through to make the bunker busters, which are built at the McAllister, Oklahoma, U.S. Army, or the military munitions plant, where everybody got sick from building them here just in the last, you know, this last year. And then we also build the landmine submunitions, the ATEM and the PETEM, which are this true, historic, perfect dirty bomb. That's a high explosive surrounded by a radioactive uranium shell casing. And we just use this all over the place, extensively.
And, of course, it really is a very, very effective weapon because it's so heavy that, of course, it'll just go right through steel, won't it? It burns right through the steel?
Yeah, it punches through everything. It's extremely effective. When the round's flying through the air, it's moving extremely high velocity, tremendous forces. It's already on fire. And then when it impacts anything, it's like a blowtorch. For example, if most people are familiar with, and they've heard of, you know, where straws or pieces of wood have got stuck into trees and gone through concrete walls during tornadoes or hurricanes. It's exactly what happens. Tremendous energies over a very small area, tremendous pressures. And when this goes through, it breaks in, and you get a shower of radioactive materials and solid radioactive materials, and all this stuff causes catastrophic secondary explosions and detonations due to either ignition that's burning or concussion. People are probably familiar with the old snap caps on the 4th of July you throw on the walkway. Well, that's picric acid in comparison to this stuff. And tremendous, tremendous explosions and detonations. So it's extremely effective. What we learned when I was director of the U.S. Army's Depleted Uranium Project in 94 and 95 and did all the research and testing, developed the materials for the military, at the, what's called the Nevada test site, Mercury, Nevada. That's about 100 miles northwest of Las Vegas. And so we couldn't clean it up. The contamination is so extensive, within 50 meters, that the military itself fully recognizes, and so does the Department of Energy, that you have to wear full respiratory and skin protection within 50 meters of any impact for eternity unless it's cleaned up. And then we know the contamination goes out over 400 meters, requiring thorough cleanup for each and every hit. So you got a chessboard, so to speak, of contamination wherever the stuff is used, whether it's in Afghanistan, the Balkans, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, up in Albany, New York, Concord, Massachusetts, Jefferson Proving Ground southeast of Indianapolis, Eglin Air Force Base in Florida, and we go on and on, VX Puerto Rico.
Now, what's going to happen to the people in Fallujah today, the people who stayed in Fallujah, the people who are returning to Fallujah, the civilians that are returning into this area that must be heavily contaminated with depleted uranium?
Well, in the last week or so, we've been getting extensive medical reports coming out of serious medical problems. I mean, that's amongst the residents there. We're already having birth defects, not only in American soldiers that we know were contaminated, tested hot for uranium by independent testing because the Department of Defense refused to do it, that then conceived children, and the children were born after they were, you know, hot for DU. But we're seeing tremendous birth defects throughout the Iraqi, you know, population, that whole area, and the same thing in the Balkans and Vieques and everywhere it's been used. So it's there. No question about it whatsoever. The health effects we're seeing, too, extensively all over. It's there. Same as what we saw in all of us right away, and it's continued to this day.
Now, many of the people from your original unit, the 300 people you had, are many of them ill as...
Oh, yes. Most of them all are. We started getting sick within 24 to 48 hours, 72 hours. First thing was respiratory, which has always been known because the radioactive materials inhaled has both chemical and radiological toxicity, particulate irritation. So So you get the chemical and particulate irritation causing respiratory problems right away. I mean, that's been known since 1943. And that was all published in the famous Groves Memorandum. And I spoke to some of the last living scientists that are still were there at that time and did this work, and they've absolutely totally confirmed that. Again,
Didn't the men in your unit, though, wear protective clothing and protective masks, things of that sort?
Oh, yeah, but they don't work. Well, absolutely, but they don't work. We found out they didn't work. The particulates are so small, and that's, you know, totally confirmed in the Handbook of Chemistry and Physics in the section on particulates and dust that, you know, they were submicron in size. So a HEPA filter mask, which is designed for, you know, about 1 micron, maybe down to 0.7 micron. This stuff is down to 0.1 micron in smaller size, so it goes right through. So that's why we could smell it and taste it, even where when we wore the best respiratory and skin protection during the military stuff that the Army had and the military had available, and the best stuff that the U.S. Department of Energy had available when we did the testing in the Nevada test site in Mercury, Nevada. But we came up hot. I mean, just absolutely came up hot and exposed. No two ways about it. And that's confirmed by the U.S. Department of Energy radiobioassays. They did. You know, even though the military never did any, DOE did.
Well, now you, of course, turn in your report, your analysis, that there was just no way that this you could deal safely with these areas that were heavily contaminated with depleted uranium. And, of course, your recommendation was that, in essence, that it should not be used. And weren't you ordered to alter your report because the Army wanted to use this because it's such an effective weapon? It has some tremendous kill capacity?
Well, absolutely, and the pressure to alter my reports and my recommendations continued up until just a few hours ago. I mean, it's continued as we're speaking. It's not ceased. We, as a part of our work, when I was director of the DU project, ended up writing U.S. Army Regulation 700-48. I mean, you can pull that down on the website. Probably the best website is a Quaker website, www.traprock.org. Now, I don't have anything to do with that. I'm not, it's totally separate from me, but they posted this, and so you can actually read the regulations up there that mandate thorough environmental remediation, what it required. You can read specific, all of the orders mandating medical care. You can even read the Pentagon, internal Pentagon briefings confirming all the adverse health and environmental effects. That's Colonel Dr. Wakayama's briefing to the leaders of the Pentagon.
Now, what would that be under in TrapRockPeace?
Just go to the TrapRockPeace.org website and then click on the depleted uranium section.
All right.
And you can, and a lot of this stuff is posted right there on the front, in the, you know, on the whole main website. But you can, you know, then, you know, move around in the website to get to all of the regulations and orders. So we wrote those, and they're, to this day, they're totally disregarded. I initially ordered medical care for everybody who was exposed right away in 1991, including myself and everybody else. Those orders have been reissued so many times, including General Eric Shinseki, who was the commanding general, you know, the head top general for the military, you know, the Army that brought everybody into, you know, the Balkans, Afghan, and Gulf War II. He himself signed the order mandating thorough medical care and environmental cleanup and training and education back in 1993. And then he's the one that formalized, again recently, back in September of 2002, the Army regulation, for which I was the primary author and coordinated all the approvals of, mandating medical care and thorough environmental remediation.
But nothing has effectively been done in response to that, is that right?
Oh, that's correct. The U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, in their most recent publication that's called Gulf War Review, Volume 13, Number 1, this is, you know, like the end of 2004, and then it came here about a month ago. They totally confirm on page 12 of Gulf War Review, Volume 13, Number 1, that as of the current time, only 270 people have ever been tested for uranium exposure. Out of over 400 names that I personally submitted, and out of thousands of people that should have, by all the written orders signed most recently by General Ronald Peake, the Surgeon General for the U.S. Army.
So if you don't examine people, you don't find the problem, then there is no problem. Is that sort of
the
way?
That's absolutely correct, and that was the standard that was started off in the beginning.
We'll be back in just a moment here as we discuss further this genocidal program for American servicemen and casualties throughout the world. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Major Doug Rocky. And now, are you still with the military, or are you retired yet?
I'm retired.
Okay,
medically
fine.
Retired.
Hey, pardon?
Medically retired with a 40% disability.
Is this it's related to
of all my work? Absolutely.
Is this directly related to your exposure to depleted uranium? Now, what about the other people in your unit? Have many of them retired? Have they been given a permanent disability as well?
Oh, yeah. The first cancer started in the larynx within 9 months. The first lung cancer started within 2 years, with the first death within 2 years. Most recent death that I know from lung cancer happened last year. And, yeah, they're sick.
Do we have any idea how many of the men have actually passed away that were in the unit?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a hard figure to put on, you know, with patient confidentiality, but we had a pretty good figure on it. It's a substantial number. And we were keeping track at one time out of all the people that were dying and all the different units that were associated with the work. But, yeah, the Pentagon will, you know, come out and say, nobody's dead, and then I take them to the grave and say, oh, really?
Now, of course, there seems to be a definite government cover-up of this. What is the explanation for that in your point of view? Do you feel that it's being covered up because they don't want to stop using this material?
Well, absolutely, but that was a written order that I got in March of 1991. I received a written order from, written by Colonel Michael Zeem from Los Alamos, New Mexico, the National Nuclear Labs, and that's called the famous Los Alamos Memorandum. You can go and pull that up a lot of websites. It's on TrapRock, or you can get to it very directly. If you go to the, you know, type in a search engine, the silver bullet and depleted uranium, that will take you to a Canadian news report, and they have those, the Los Alamos Memorandum, very clearly on there, and you can read that for yourself. Very saying, lying the reports to sustain the DU use. In other words, you have to make it totally acceptable by just not acknowledging anything that happened. And also on that same website, there was another memorandum I got simultaneously in 91, and that's written by Colonel Greg Lyle of the United States Defense Nuclear Agency. That's the head nuke guys. That's saying it's a serious health hazard. We're going to have all kinds of problems. So, I mean, we saw it. We did it. We did the research. We saw the people getting sick. We realized the medical care was not going to happen then. It has not happened to this day. And we're seeing serious health effects from exposure to a radiological material that has both chemical and radiological toxicity. And as the U.S. Army Environmental Policy Institute report that we published in 1995 states very clearly, there's no way to change or alter the toxicity of DU. It's not possible.
Well, now, of course,
can't do it.
Before I really started putting you on and other people speaking on depleted uranium, I went to the Internet and checked the reports out of the Royal Society of Great Britain, which is a pretty responsible medical organization, and they acknowledge everything that you're saying, that certainly they feel that the uranium miners have tremendous problems and cancers and a statistically significant increase in health problems. And then, of course, even the United Nations committees have come out and condemn the use of depleted uranium weaponry, haven't they?
Oh, absolutely. The United Nations Subcommittee on Human Rights had issued a directive and said that it was an illegal weapon, a weapon of mass destruction, many, many years ago. And the reason for that is very clear. It's indiscriminate. It lasts forever. It doesn't just affect the combatants during the time of combat. And as the U.S. Army states very specifically in its own DOLRAM, the common task that all military personnel must pass as a military personnel every year. It states very clearly in there that depleted uranium contamination will make food and water unusable.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Major Doug Rocky, who's now retired with a 40% disability from the military. And, of course, he's been trying to get the message out about really the terrible danger, not only to our own troops, but to the other troops and to the civilians. Because in many parts of Iraq today, where we have, of course, bombed the area and shelled the area and machine gunned the area, they must be terribly heavily contaminated with this uranium oxide. And once it's there, there's really no way to get rid of it, can you? Is there any way that you can suck it up or that you can bury it or that you can get rid of it?
Well, we developed all the guidelines when I did the research in the Nevada test site, Mercury, Nevada, 94 and 95. That's published in the U.S. Army regulation and accompanying U.S. Army pamphlet. That's U.S. Army Regulation 700-48. And then also there's a technical bulletin 9-1300-278 that's also on Trap Rock. You can pull it up and read. And what we learned and what we did is just minimal, you know, minimal effectiveness, but we had to do that. That's the reason why the regulation exists. And what it requires is total identification, isolation, securing, collection, packaging, and disposal of all radioactive materials. And that's just depleted uranium. It's all the other radioactive materials caused by the use of uranium emissions and other explosives that just totally contaminated. Because we have to remember, radioactive materials are used extensively through agriculture, through industry, through medicine, and education. And so it's there. And then it's in the military equipment that we have, but then it's definitely in extensively in the military equipment made by in the Soviet bloc, Warsaw Pact countries. You know, again, Iraq's military equipment that they have. We put the guidelines together. The U.S. Army Technical Bulletin that we was modified based on our research when I was director requires that if you're going to have removable contamination, either alpha or beta, there'd be no radioactivity measurements or dose rates or exposures there at all. And if you're going to have fixed contamination from alpha, it should not exceed 200 counts per minute. And then the beta-gamma component should be not any greater than 0.05 millirems per hour. That's the maximum permissible dose rates by the U.S. Army guidelines.
Well, now what about the shells? Let's say you have the shells that you're going to be using, maybe your 20-millimeter shells, something like that, the tank would use. Are those shells just sitting there intact, or if they haven't been fired, do they emit any radiation?
Well, absolutely. But, you know, when you got a large round, they're in, you know, in a casing, and they're in the ammo compartment, it's not a whole lot of hazard. Now, when we did the work for the 25-millimeter in the Bradley fighting vehicle, and I did the research on that and we did the measurements, I mean, yes, if they're in there for an extended period of time, yeah, they're going to get a dose rate that exceeds the maximum level of 100 millirems per year total. They'll just get it in a few hours, but they'll definitely exceed that. And where they're sitting on it primarily is going to go to the gonads. So you have real serious problems. And again, we know that all this stuff can have alter the DNA and the RNA and thus cause birth effects, and it has horrible effects on the cells. But once you get into the body after it's been blown up, you know, it's the DU doesn't blow up, but it causes secondary explosions, spreading the stuff all over. That stuff gets airborne, it gets into air, water, and soil, you get it in the wound, and it has catastrophic health effects. Not acute radiological health effects, but subclinical that just have the same serious health problems.
You know, there is an incidence then of lung cancer. What other sort of cancers do the people get?
Cancers that have showed up on team members and people that I can verify. We've got the lung cancers, we got the nasal and pharyngeal, we've got the skin cancers. Obviously, we had the cancers down in the testicles and everything else with the soldiers. We've had all kinds of health effects on the females, catastrophic health effects on females. And what's astonishing to this day, I mean, as we look at the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs acknowledgement in the Gulf War Review, Volume 13, Number 1, which was just published and released, they say only 270 people have been tested. Well, that's only a fraction of the names I've submitted, and only a very small fraction of thousands upon thousands of Americans should be tested. Doesn't include any of the non-combatants, and it doesn't include any military personnel from other countries. It's real simple. The decision was made many years ago. At the highest levels, do not complete the test. And if you don't complete the test, you won't find the exposure, and therefore we can absolutely deny any correlation between observed adverse health effects and exposures.
In other words, if you don't look for it, you won't find it.
Absolutely, and that's the operative word to this day, as confirmed by the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, Gulf War Review, Volume 13, Number 1.
Now, where is that available? Is that
Well, you can go to any VA hospital and just pick it up in the lobbies. All over the place, or you can go to the VA website, www.va.gov, and, you know, pull up Gulf War Review, and then just go to Volume 13, Number 1, go to page 12.
All right, fine. And how many pages would it be on that?
Well, it's just on one page where you get that. And what's astonishing when you get here is that you'll see the confirmed casualty count that the VA, you know, the VA says has happened from the Persian Gulf Service through Gulf War II, and that's up to the present, and they give a total figure of 89.
Hold that thought right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this evening, Major Doug Rocky. And you were going to tell us that what these figures were, what their estimates of disability or injury are.
Yeah, if you go to, again, Golf War Review, Volume 13, Number 1, Page 12, it states, and I'll quote this, the total number of Gulf War veterans have a completed examination since the program began. This is 1990 through August of 2004, is 89,143, and that includes 279 from Operation Iraqi Freedom. Okay, and they say very specifically there's a total number of 270 people have been tested for uranium exposure. That's out of thousands that should have, and over 400 names that I submitted. And then when you actually go to the formal VA reports, okay, the formal Department of Veteran Affairs casualty data reports that deal with disability, okay, you find entirely different figures. And so I'm going to go to those right now, the actual formal report published by the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs for the Compensation and Pension Division. That's the people that award disabilities, okay? And as I go to that actual report, what we need to understand is the numbers are substantially different. So for everybody that has gone into the Persian Gulf region from August of 1990 through May of 2004, which is where I have the solid data, you know, right now you can pull it up on the website and it's updated every week. There was a total of 1,129,312 of America's sons and daughters that were deployed into the Persian Gulf from August of 1990 through May of 2004. As of May 2004, out of that 1,129,312, there's only 901,692 that are still alive. And as of May of 2004, 327,323 had filed claims for permanent disability due to combat injuries from service in the Persian Gulf.
Now, what is the number again?
327,323.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that 327,323 that have filed claims as of May of 2004, the United States Department of Veteran Affairs had awarded permanent disability to 257,854. They denied claims to 33,922, and there's, you know, probably 40,000 claims still pending. So when you go to the actual reports from the Compensation and Pension Statistics for the VA on disability, you have total acknowledgement of 257,854 on permanent disability already. We have to fight for care every day, and you have 5 or 6 month waiting list for medical care. That's a total contrast.
Hold on, talk. All right, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Major Rocky, and he was basically saying that there have been actually 200, and he's quoting now from the Gulf War report of volume 13. You get that out of the VA website, and he says that if you go to the where they talk about pensions, that actually 257,000 Gulf War veterans are currently receiving pensions. Is that right? And there are 327,323 who have applied for pensions. Is that correct?
That is correct. But when you go to the Gulf War Review, volume 13, number 1, in there they state that there's only 89,143, and then including 279 from Operation Iraqi Freedom. When we go to the Operation Iraqi Freedom statistics for permanent disability as of August of 2004, the known figure is 27,571. And that number is, it's gone way up since then. And that does not include the combat wounds. These are the ones with what we call disease and non-battle injuries. To include at that time 153 cases of cancer.
Are you suggesting that there is an organized effort to lie to the American people?
Absolutely. I mean, it is verified by their own documents. When you go to the Gulf War Review, Volume 12, Volume 13, Number 1, and you go back to Volume 12, you can see all the statistics changing. When you go to volume 13, number 1, and it says only 89,143 people have gone through the program, and that includes 279 for Operation Iraqi Freedom, and then when you go to the actual pension statistics report from the VA, and you get a number of, you know, 257,000 on permanent disability, 327,000 applied, and then you see a number for Operation Iraqi Freedom of 27,571 in contrast to 279, looks very clear.
And I think that it's so difficult for the average American to realize that there is an active effort to confuse people by simply lying to them. It's very hard for people to believe that government officials would blatantly lie and nobody would ever call them on it. But the truth is, few people call them on it. Few people are willing to sit down and struggle through these long, detailed reports to see what's really going on. But I think it's very clear that we've sacrificed so many of these young men in a massive experiment that continues to this very day.
Yeah, I mean, it's not stopped.
Now,
it's absolutely not stopping, because in the last 24 hours, Department of Defense officials have launched continuous attack after attack at the most recent reports that have come out, you know, documenting this and verifying whatever it is with, you know, total documentation.
Which are the most recent reports?
The most recent report is in Crawford, Texas, which is hometown.
Now, tell us about that.
Well, the Iconoclast, which is the hometown newspaper for Crawford, Texas, George Bush's hometown, published the reports on all of this information. And the Department of Defense representatives, Department of Energy guys, they went bonkers in the last 24 hours.
Would you mind sending me a copy of that report? Do you have it on email or what?
We can send that.
Do you send it by email or fax?
Email.
All right, fine.
I'll send it to you tomorrow.
Email address. I'll appreciate it. Now, for our listeners, there was a very good article in Vanity Fair. When was that? November of last year?
That was in December of last year. It was extremely good, thoroughly documented and everything else. And it talks about the known adverse health effects, known birth effects, and most recent ones. Totally documents and verifies that the Department of Defense officials lied during their interviews for the article in Vanity Fair. And they continued to do that even up to the latest date on Vanity Fair. It's a tremendously fine article. We've got another one. Extensive stuff is on a website called Axis of Logic. We've been doing radio shows. All the experts have been getting together doing radio shows all over the country and the world for a long time. It's important to understand those of us that are yelling and screaming the loudest were those individuals that had the responsibility within the Army or the Department of Defense for either the science, the field operations, or the medical end of this. We saw what was happening. We didn't like it. We reported it, and we became persona non grata.
And I think it's so very significant. Now, this Vanity Fair article, weren't you quoted in that, and then weren't you viciously attacked by government officials for what happened? Why don't you tell the story?
Well, you know, Vanity Fair came and they did the interview, not only myself, with everybody else involved, totally verified what would happen, took our reports, read our actual reports, looked at the officer evaluation reports, all the letters of commendation and everything, and wrote it all up. And then the Department of Defense officials were very blatant. They had to disagree and disregard it. So they said, well, Dr. Rocky did not there. He didn't do the research. He wasn't director and all this stuff. And very simple, all the documents verified otherwise. Well, that's continued on even within the last 24 hours. They have to shoot the messenger in order to prevent the message from getting out.
Because the one thing is they do not want the American people to learn the truth. Now, people of Europe understand this, don't they? People in other parts of the world, what about the Iraqi people? Don't they realize they're being poisoned?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of people do when everybody's yelling and screaming at the top of their lungs. You know, with this is coming down, you have to understand. The United States Army Regulation 700-48 requires thorough environmental remediation of all depleted uranium contamination. That's not an option. That order was put in place when it was signed by General Eric Shinseki and has not been changed or altered. That regulation also requires thorough medical care for all exposures. But then in April of, 2004, the latest iteration, General Ronald Peake, the Surgeon General for the U.S. Army, the top doctor, issued the order in April of 2004 mandating thorough medical care for all DU casualties. Now, you can't order medical care for all Americans who are DU casualties and then deny the medical care, which they're doing. But more important, you can't order that medical care for all Americans and deny that to any of our coalitions, which they continue to do. But more important, you can't deny that medical care to the Geneva Convention under what they call the so-called enemy combatants. But more important, you absolutely can't deny that mandated medical care to all the civilians, whether they're in Vieques, Puerto Rico, or, you know, or they're sitting at any of the sites where they manufacture it, whether it's in Concord, Massachusetts, where our nation was born. Cancer rates and birth defects are legendary up there.
Or well, now, what is there? Is there an enrichment plant up there or what?
That's where they make the manufacture of the DU munitions.
Okay.
And the same thing at near Albany, New York, at the National Lead site. It's just all over the place. So it's real simple. The U.S. Army regulations and orders signed by the Surgeon General require thorough medical care for all DU casualties. And it's not done. Not only for our own, but for anybody else. And again, we have to understand, since 1992, I submitted over 400 names personally as the guy that had the responsibility for this and got a lot of medals from the generals, commanding generals for it. They've only tested 270 people since 1972, or since 1992. 270 people. That's it.
Now, I understand, though, that there have been some people who have been doing the testing on their own. Wasn't it Dr. Durakovich?
Well, yeah.
Who had actually done, he's a colonel of some sort, has some maybe retired, whatever it is. He's actually been testing people and found out that significant numbers of our military personnel are heavily contaminated with DU. What's the story there?
Well, that's actually correct. He's another persona non grata. That's Dr. Colonel, he's a U.S. Army colonel, U.S. Army physician. He was a U.S. Army and the U.S. Department of Veterans' foremost expert on this as a physician until he spoke up. And, again, now he's been doing in private practice, doing the testing and verifying the exposures. He's the one that did the testing on the, you know, New York's finest police and fire personnel that got activated in the 442nd Military Police New York National Guard unit that went to Iraq, got contaminated, came back, got sick, and the children were born with birth defects. It was his group that verified they were hot, and then we saw the health effects come on down. You have to understand that the U.S. military, this weapon system is incredible. And from the Los Alamos Memorandum and all the other ones, they will not give up this weapon system. They cannot acknowledge the adverse health and environmental effects just because of the catastrophic cost, but more important, we use weapons of mass destruction ourselves, and then we ignored what's happened. We manufactured them. We release the contamination, ignores what's happened since day one.
Well, is this one reason why the Bush administration is so fearful of the International Criminal Court and the charges of war crimes against our leaders and our military leaders for doing this?
Well, the indictments already come down for the use of DU, absolutely. They just totally ignore them. I'm getting very tired here. I just had surgery the other day.
Oh, I'm sorry.
To clean things up. So I'm running out of steam here real, real fast, and it's real, real late.
All right, fine. Well, we can certainly let you go. Oh, we actually have a caller. Do you want to take his call?
Sure.
Or do you want to take
absolutely. We can do that.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to Roger, who's calling from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Roger, do you have a question for Major Rocky?
Yes, if you please. I'd first like to beg all our prayers for you, Major, and your family. And I would like to ask, I can well accept that the use of these types of rounds would be immoral on virtually, if not universally, under the conditions of which they are used. I'm just asking you to further clarify, if you can, would there be even the thinnest pretext to argue that either this failing to use them could lead to, say, a few percent more front side losses for Americans, or that it might require 20% more ordnance to be expended for certain, if not destruction, but valid military objectives?
All right, fine. Thank you so much, Roger. And of course, basically, Roger is saying, can this be justified, or is the Army justifying this? Because it is such an effective weapon, far more effective than anything else available.
Well, that's exactly how they justify it, based on a lethality overmatch. And you have to understand, what systems are we gone up against? It's totally unnecessary to use uranium munitions to shoot up apartment buildings and water treatment facilities and houses. It's totally unnecessary to shoot up standard conventional automobiles, cars, and trucks. And the Iraqi military had absolutely no armor that could not be penetrated by conventional munitions. You got to understand, when you go to war, you're going to use the best weapon system you have, and this stuff's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. But, I mean, you have to come back to the fundamental basics. What right does the United States or any nation have to take tons and tons of solid radioactive materials that are both chemically toxic and radiologically toxic and throw it in anybody's backyard and then simply refuse to provide the mandated medical care required by their own orders and regulations, and simply refuse to clean up with all the environmental contamination that they must clean up as required by their own orders and regulations. I mean, you got to come to common sense.
Well, I think sometimes when I analyze what's going on in the world today, Major, that I find there's very little common sense, that there's very little that makes sense. And once you understand that, then everything begins to fit into place.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I went into the director of the DU project and cleaned this up after Gulf War, my intent was to ensure, you know, as a warrior, which I've been because I came in 1967. So I've served in two wars and just retired, so that's many, many years. I went through all the enlisted ranks and the officer ranks combined, so it's been on both ends of the scale, in both the U.S. Air Force and the Army. And what you learn, real simple, is sometimes the weapon systems that you use and the techniques that you use, you can't justify. And that doesn't mean that, you know, we don't have to go to war, we can't go to war, or we don't have to, you know, sometimes we're not going to have new weapon systems. But we have to look at what are the not only immediate, long-term health and environmental effects of the weapon systems we have. And today, the weapon systems that we have, the techniques that we use, leave catastrophic results, both immediate, acute clinic medically, and subclinical medically, for which we have no ability to provide medical care, and we don't have the ability to clean up the environment. And the conclusion I reached was we can't do this anymore.
I agree with you totally. Hey, thanks very much, Roger. Let's go to Jeff calling from Michigan. Jeff, do you have a question for our guest?
Obviously, Pandora's box is wide open. Major Rocky, I believe this would be just cause to have all the troops recalled from, was it, Dr. Stan, 140 countries they're in now?
Something like that. Well, I don't think it's going to happen, but I think it's certainly, I would be much happier if our troops were here guarding America than, of course, pursuing the imperialistic goals of our invisible government. Do you have a question for our guest?
Well, I wanted his opinion on recalling the troops, and also could he please give the website slowly so I could write it down.
All right. What do you think about recalling the troops, number one, and what's the website? Is that the Trap Rock website?
Correct. www.traprockpeace. That's www.traprockpeace.org.
TrapRockPeace.org.
Yeah, and that's a Quaker group out of Woolman Hill in Deerfield, Massachusetts. Quakers. You got to understand, Quakers have been at the forefront of peace for since antiquity, haven't they?
Right.
Amazing.
Yeah, and as far as recalling the troops, yeah. I mean, you sure can have troops in areas where we've used this and we've caused the contamination where we're continuing to use this stuff. But when you go to war or go to battle, we have to have total justification for what's happening. And as Gulf War II and Afghanistan and the Balkans, all that was totally based on lies, as everybody has verified to this day. But you know, people still go along with this nonsense.
In fact, it was Colin Powell who apparently told President Bush, and when President Bush wanted to go to war, Colin Powell said, well, if you break it, it's yours. Meaning, if you destroy the government of Iraq, why, you have to take care of it until it's stabilized. And that's exactly what we did, and doesn't look like we're doing a very good job of stabilizing it. Jeff, did you have anything else you wanted to ask our guest?
No, I just, God bless him, and I'll certainly be praying for his success.
Well, Major, I really appreciate your being with us this evening. I know that if you're running out of gas, I've been there too, and it's late back there. So thank you so very much. I think you've done a lot to educate our listeners who are not well acquainted with this subject. God bless you. We'll talk to you later when you're feeling better.
Yeah, thanks, Stan. Again, the whole thing is we need to ensure the President of the United States is Commander-in-Chief, ensures that all members of the Department of Defense comply with U.S. Army regulations and orders that require thorough medical care for all of our DU casualties and all military casualties, and that they clean up all environmental contamination that's required by their Army regulations and orders. It's that simple. They just need to do their job. And what I've been trying to do is ensure that they do their job as it's required to be done.
And you're not very, very popular when you do that.
Oh, not at all.
Well, I appreciate if you'd send me that article out of the President's Crawford newspaper.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
IOL class, you can probably pull it up on their website. Hold on, let me give you the website.
All right.
www.iconoclast-texas.com. That's www.iconoclast-texas.com.
All right.
No website.
All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you, sir.
Good night. God bless. All right, fine. Well, our guest this evening has been Major Doug Rocky. We've actually had him on our program before. We have a four-tape set on depleted uranium with previous interviews with Dr. Rocky, and he does have his PhD. It's in nuclear physics. He's well-educated, well-trained, and he's a voice in the wilderness trying to get people to understand that we're destroying not only our citizens, our soldiers, but the citizens of Iraq. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we let Dr. Rocky go because he was getting rather tired. But this is really a very, very important subject. Before I would actually go on the air and publicly talk about depleted uranium, you always wonder, are we being put on? You know, is this simply another rabbit trail that they want to send people down? I went up on the internet. I researched the material from the Royal Institute of Medicine in Great Britain. And yes, they feel that there's a very real problem and a real danger from depleted uranium. And they've gone into the studies of what happens to uranium miners. And they have people work in uranium mines, which where they mine what we refer to as depleted uranium. These people, you know, even when this is not a matter of dust at all, getting into their lungs, that they still have a much higher incidence of lung cancer and other diseases in the miners. And then, of course, there's the information is coming from various United Nations committees, and I don't have the highest respect for the United Nations, but, you know, when you have these committees coming forward and talking about the dangers of depleted uranium, when you find out that there are groups all over Europe that are complaining about this, the Arabs understand that we are poisoning them and unborn generations of Arab children. They know that we killed half a million Iraqi children when we had the embargo on between 1991 and about 1995 before we actually released the embargo, and a half a million Iraqi children died. And that's one thing Osama bin Laden has talked about, is our callous disregard for the Iraqi children that were killed. We, as Americans, have an obligation to get the truth and find out if this is so, because men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And if these things are going on, why we should be involved. We're told that Dante wrote in his Inferno, his classic book, The Inferno, that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who in a time of moral crisis maintained a position of neutrality. The hottest places in hell are reserved for those who in a time of moral crisis maintained a position of neutrality. And we are in a moral crisis today. And we're being lied to by our leaders. We're being lied to by our military. We're being lied to by the Veterans Administration. But then what should we expect when we've taken God out of our schools and God out of our courts and nobody in government is ever punished for lying to the American people? And how many more American boys are going to die, and how many more deformed American children will there be? Well, that's going to be up to you out there in the listening audience listening tonight. Well, this is Dr. Stan. This is not a nice subject, but it's an important subject because it goes right along with all the other genocidal policies that are taking place today, whether it be the release of a drug like Vioxx when they knew ahead of time that when Vioxx was released, it was going to kill tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of Americans. And if you haven't seen my April newsletter, it's simply Dr. David Graham's testimony before the Senate. We've simply given you the important parts of his testimony. We'd be glad to send you a free copy of our April newsletter if you call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And we point out that we simply quote Dr. Graham, who pointed out that before Vioxx was ever released to the public, Merck Company knew that it increased the incidence of heart disease sevenfold, 700%. And it was released to the public without a warning, not telling the doctors, not telling the people. They knew it was going to kill people. Why? Because we're dealing with organized evil, ladies and gentlemen. And once you recognize that, you'll understand the frustration that Dr. Graham had as he saw what was happening and realized that tens of thousands of Americans were dying of heart attack, a direct result of this, heart attack and stroke. And yet, where is the outcry? Is anybody going to be punished? Oh, no, there may be some lawsuits, but I think the head of Merck lost his job, but nobody's going to go to prison. And yet this is a frank case of murder. They knew what they were doing. And it was not only the people at Merck. It was the people within the Federal Drug Administration, where we have some of the finest government officials that money can buy. But there are also other motivations besides money. There are people who are frankly wicked and evil. And when you understand that, you can understand depleted uranium. You can understand the mercury in the vaccines that have destroyed the minds of almost a generation of our children. You can understand why, when our children graduate from high school today and they're compared in scholastic aptitude tests with children from other countries, our children can't compete. Why? Because their minds have been poisoned with aspartame and NutraSweet. Their minds have been poisoned with fluoride. Their minds have been poisoned with mercury. And these things did not happen by accident. If you'd like more information, certainly you'll want to get our latest video. It's my video on water fluoridation and the whole subject of fluoride contamination, aerosol contamination. If you ever read the Clean Air Act, not one word of fluoride contamination, and yet it's one of the major pollutants that comes from burning coal. Why isn't it in the Clean Air Act? Because they don't want that to be included. They don't want you to understand how fluoride, the most active of all the elements on the periodic table, is being used to poison the American people. You'll certainly want to get my latest video, my personal video on fluoride, and the syllabus that goes with that, the hidden agenda, the fluoride deception. So you'll want to get that video. You'll certainly want to get the new video that we put out on the coming financial crisis. Pardon me, these are both DVDs, they're not videos. My video on the, pardon me, my DVD on fluoride, and my DVD on certainly on the hidden agenda, and you get the two of them together, the syllabus and the DVD on fluoride will be to your advantage. And then, of course, we have material on mercury poisoning and on the fact that the aspartame, you know, we hear so much about pathological obesity in our children. Oh, my goodness. It's the colonel's fault? No. Many of these are directly related to the use of NutraSweet, which has been known since 1970 to produce pathological obesity in animals and endocrine disturbances, and all of the things that NutraSweet does produce. And that's why it's being allowed to be used in this country. They know what it's doing. They just don't want you to know. You'll certainly want to get our book, Excitotoxins, The Taste That Kills. You'll want to get our four-tape set on aspartame, and the video on mercury, the video certainly on aspartame. All of this is available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And we'll be back here in just a moment for the next hour. Maria, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line one of my favorite guests. And his name is Ron Brown, and Ron supports Radio Liberty. He is, of course, in the coin business. He buys and sells gold coins. But I found him to be a very reliable observer of what's really going on throughout the country and the financial basis today. And really, there's some fascinating material out there, and we're going to be talking with Ron about that. Certainly a recent article written by Paul Volcker in the Washington Post. And those of you who have not yet read that article really need to get hold of it. We can always send you one. You can go up on the Internet, though, and type it in if you'd like to get it. But Paul Volcker basically said this: under the placid surface, there are disturbing trends, huge imbalances. This risks, call them what you will. Altogether, the circumstances seem to me as dangerous and intractable as any I can remember, and I can remember quite a lot. What really concerns me is that there seems to be so little willingness or capacity to do much about it. Personal savings in the United States have practically disappeared. To be sure, businesses have begun to rebuild their financial reserves, but in the space of a few years, the federal deficit has come to offset that source of national savings. What holds it all together is a massive and growing flow of capital from abroad, running to more than $2 billion every working day and growing. More recently, we've become more dependent on foreign central banks, particularly in China and Japan and elsewhere in East Asia. The difficulty is that this seemingly comfortable pattern can't go on indefinitely. I don't know of any country that has managed to consume and invest 6% more than it produces for long. The United States is absorbing about 80% of the net flow of international capital, and at some point, both central banks and private institutions will have their fill of dollars. I don't know whether change will come with a bang or a whimper, whether sooner or later, but as things stand, it's more likely than not that it will be a financial crisis rather than policy foresight that will force the change. A wise observer of the economic scene once commented that what can be left to later usually is, and then, alas, it's too late. Now, ladies and gentlemen, Paul Volcker is a member of the group that rules the world. He's one of the major financial experts. He was former chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, long associated with the Chase Manhattan Bank, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, one of the leaders of the central banking conspiracy, because that's what it really is, that rules the banks of the world. And when he tells you these things, that he doesn't know whether it's going to come with a bang or a whimper, whether sooner or later, but he believes a financial crisis is coming, you better listen to what he has to say. Have you read that article, Ron? Have you had a chance to see it?
I have seen it.
What are your thoughts? Why is he telling this? I think the important thing is not what he's saying, because everything he's saying is true, but why is he telling us this?
Well, I always think back to the guy that kind of put him in business, David Rockefeller, who made a statement way back in the 80s, I guess, or the 90s early. He said, the world is ready for a new world order. All we need is the right financial crisis.
And I think maybe that right financial crisis is coming, and Paul Volcker is telling us, and with the new world order, of course, will be the loss of freedom, the loss of everything we have from our material possession, our annuities, our bank deposits, our bonds, our everything we own physically, and perhaps our lives as well.
I lose track of time sometimes, but wasn't Paul Volcker still in his position in 1987 when the first crash came?
No, as I remember, he got out probably maybe about the mid-1980s, but I could be mistaken. You know, certainly he was there. He did the right thing in 1980, and then he persisted there on into the Reagan administration.
That's right.
But pretty soon, I think Greenspan came in probably, certainly 83, 84. Maybe somebody out there could look that up and get us the exact information. But certainly Alan Greenspan then came on and did everything absolutely wrong. Instead of reining in the availability of money, he massively expanded it. He created the greatest expansion of monetary supply and liquidity in the history, not only of our nation, but the entire world, at least as far as, you know, I should say of our nation. Of course, other countries have increased liquidity, and they've always collapsed. And, of course, this is where we're headed today. I really fear, and people have to be aware of what's going on and begin making preparations accordingly.
Yeah, but Volcker was in charge in 82 when they basically made the announcement, we're going to open the money spigot and start to print our way out of this mess. And then by, of course, 1987, the stock market had gone from less than 1,000, was above 3,200, and we had the 87 crash in October. And that's when they created the Plunge Protection Team, which then, at that point, we were afraid to allow another serious recession because the debt structure was getting so large that the thought of a major recession could topple the whole debt system. So we've been on a juggling act ever since that they just keep bailing out the system, unlike Volcker did back in 80. Every time we approach a major crisis or a recession, they get so scared of a recession they just strike a printing press roll and bail us out. Of course, every time they do it, the consequences of the next recession get even worse. So it's really turned into an absolute bubble that cannot last for much, much longer.
Well, of course, if the other countries of the rest of the world would continue pouring their money into the United States and impoverishing their people, then, of course, it could go on forever. But why would anybody else, why would other countries want to impoverish their people and ship 80% of the reserves of the entire world into the United States so we can live well and they can live poorly? And, of course, I believe there is a plan, a master plan, to redistribute the wealth of this country, and I think it's only some major incident that is going to bring this whole financial house of cards right down. And it won't be on top of Alan Greenspan and Paul Volcker. It will be on the shoulders of all of us. Well, this is Arthur Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Ron Brown, and we were simply discussing the article that Paul Volcker, certainly one of the men who rules the world, he's part and parcel of this financial elite that controls the central banking system of the world, and in his article published the 10th of April of this year in the Washington Post, he basically said that other countries are not going to continue to finance America's deficit. There's never been any incident in history where a nation has consumed 6% more than it produced, and it can't go on for long for absorbing 80% of the world's reserves, and sooner or later the other central banks and other countries of the world are going to be sick and tired of financing our deficits, and when they stop, why the whole house of cards comes down. And really what is so incredible about this whole thing that's going on today is it would almost appear that we are doing everything we can to antagonize the rest of the world. We've pretty well antagonized the people of Europe because we went into Iraq. We antagonized the Arab world, this story that appeared in Newsweek magazine. And if any of you out there really believe that this was just an accident, we just didn't know what we were doing. Oh, shucks. I mean, the story of flushing a Koran down the toilet at Guantanamo, why would you publish a story like that? And why, if it was a false story, is nobody being published? And why is the Bush administration saying, oh, what a terrible thing to do? Why, you're giving the Arab world the wrong impression of America? Ladies and gentlemen, this is all play acting. We are doing everything we can to antagonize the Islamic world, creating the best enemy money could buy. We saw this with publication of the pictures of what was going on in Guantanamo. And then the revelation getting out on 60 Minutes about the horrible mistreatment and sexual humiliation of the prisoners there. How do you think that plays in the Arab world? And then the story about Abu Ghraib. Why did we allow those pictures to be put out all over the world? Certainly with the control that our government has, they could have stopped those pictures from getting out. They could have cut them off the Internet. But instead of that, they're doing everything they can to inflame the rest of the world. Why would you do something like that unintentionally? And I'd like to suggest, I don't think it's unintentional at all, and I think there are going to be terrible repercussions as we inflame the passions of the people of Europe and in South America and of Africa and of Asia against the United States. And we cannot stand alone as long as, of course, we have, we've taken down our tariff barriers, we've become interdependent, and we are now totally dependent upon the tyrannical government of communist China and the benevolent government of Japan to keep American economic system afloat. I'm very worried about that. How about you, Ron?
Well, it obviously can't go on forever, and I think we're approaching the end of it when you look at all the financial aggregates, the way the trade deficit is just exploding. You know, was it, what, 2 or 3 years ago, they announced that they were going to allow the dollar to slide so it would correct the trade balance. And I think the trade balance was running, what, $40 billion a month then, or a little less. And here we are, 3 years later, the dollar's dropped 30-40%, and yet the trade balance just keeps going up and up and up. It's been over $60 billion the last 2 or 3 months. So, you know, figures like that just can't go on forever. But the problem with any bubble, of course, is you never know when it's going to end. People were predicting the end of the dot-com bubble back in the mid-90s, and of course it went on till 2000. So when you start predicting the end of a bubble, you can have egg on your face for 2, 3, 4 years. People kind of laugh at you as you do, but when the bubble pops, if you're still in the game, the party's over. And that's exactly what happened to people in March of 2000 when the NASDAQ collapsed from, what, 5,200 down into the low teens. So,
somebody once said that you can't see a bubble when you're inside the bubble, and I think we're inside the bubble today. And certainly the housing bubble is, it should be obvious to anybody that you can't keep increasing the price of homes indefinitely. You know, one of these days, why the prices are going to have to begin leveling out, but when they're going up 20, 30, 40% sometimes a year, this is truly a bubble, and it's being created by a phony credit. I got a notation today that if we wanted to finance our house, finance it 100% with 1% interest. Now, how can that possibly be? 100% financing and 1% interest. Obviously, they're literally giving money away. Of course, one of these days when the interest rate goes up, why, of course, a lot of the people who are foolish enough to take out these loans are going to find that they not only are going to lose their home, but it may very well that they won't be able to walk away from their liability, because I think that the people in charge know what's going to happen. That's why they passed the new bankruptcy law, so you can't walk away from your debts. And what we've done by federal legislation is ensure a permanent indentured servitude for a large segment of the American people who are today have overburdened with debt. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with you, and it kind of reminds me the dot-com bubble at the tail end. It kept going up and up and up, and people were so euphoric with it that they were actually using their credit cards to buy stock because it was a no-lose situation. And, of course, when it popped, people got wiped out dramatically. Now we see the same thing in the real estate market. When you see people financing their homes with zero down and interest only, gosh, that's the same as using your credit card. The difference between this bubble popping and the dot-com bubble popping is that most people that were in the stock market were in it with their savings, and so when it popped, they lost a good percentage of their savings, but they still had some money left. When you look at the real estate bubble, with people going out and buying these unbelievably overpriced homes with zero down, and they're mortgaging their themselves for life when the dot-com bubble, real estate bubble pops. You know, some of these $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 houses are going to be worth $300,000 and $400,000, and that person will have literally mortgaged himself or put himself in bondage for life because he'll never pay that back.
And as we begin looking and seeing what's happening to our economy, we find that Ford and General Motors bonds have gone to the junk level. That means they're going to have to be paying 10.5% or 11.5% interest on the money they borrow this year, and probably 12.5% to 13.5% interest on the money they're going to have to borrow next year, and they're going to have to borrow somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 billion between Ford and General Motors, money next year for operations. You've got to make an awful lot of money profit before you can afford to pay that amount of interest. You're talking about, you know, $20 or $30 billion just in interest payments before you make a profit. Trouble is, of course, that they have to pay their pension funds. If the pension funds are invested at all in the stock market and the stock market turns down, then, of course, they're going to have to put more money in the stock market. Right now, General Motors has about $20 billion in cash reserves, but it owes $17 billion to its pension fund. And, you know, it may very well be that Ford and General Motors are going to have to just walk away from their pension fund obligations, as United Airlines has recently done. And probably several other airlines are going to have to do in the near future. And that is, of course, going to put the burden for the pension benefit guarantee corporation right on the hands of the American taxpayers. And you're talking $500 billion to $1 trillion in pension funds. And still, the people are probably only going to get 40 or 50 cents on the dollar.
Well, that's true, and when you look at this inflation, this euphoric boom we've had for 20-something years, what always happens is certain segments of the economy can't keep up with what's going on, and I think the pension plan is the next major bubble. You were just talking about GM, but, you know, if you just look at their situation, and if you just think back 20 years, Dr. Stan, if either one of us were the actuary trying to plan for the medical benefits of the retired people, how could we have possibly foreseen what was going to happen to medical expenses? What was insurance back then? Maybe $100 a month? Now it's, what, $500 a month? So Ford Motor Company, I don't know if you just mentioned this, they just came out with a price increase, and $1,500 per unit of that increase is going to go simply just to paying off the medical and the pension plan. So I think you would find that many of the major corporations in America are in very serious straits with their pension plans already, and yet they have the money invested in either stocks or bonds at a very time when the stock market is threatening to break down below 10,000 and interest rates are threatening to go up, which would decimate the bond market. So if they're in bad straits now, what's going to happen if we have another downdraft on these markets?
Well, you know, I think I've been watching General Motors, and they've been building major automotive production plants over in China. Now, why are they building major plants in China? Are they planning on selling cars to the Chinese people? I don't think so. I think they're planning on building cars for the United States over in China and finding some means, or rather simply to walk away from their pension agreements and from their labor agreements with the unions here in the United States. And then they can, of course, compete with the Chinese and other countries, other companies that are shipping their products into the United States. And as long as we don't have any tariff barriers, then they'll be able, of course, to once again perhaps get things straightened out. But first of all, they've got to simply cut off their pension obligations and get rid of all their employers in the United States. But what will that do? What will that do to the economy of this country when some of the last major industrial employers are producing over in Japan and, pardon me, over in China? Why, we're going to be back here in just a moment. We'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. I'd like to know what you think about what's going on, because I think people have to understand that we are in real trouble from many points of view. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. And, of course, our financial advisor, one of them, just called in and said that the destruction of the credit bubble, the walking away from the pension funds, the cutting back on the price of housing is deflationary and could be a very, very negative thing for silver and gold. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's obviously deflationary. Most people, we've been miseducated on what inflation is, so most people get very, very confused. Most of us think that inflation is just higher prices and deflation is lower prices, when in reality those are just symptoms. Inflation is the increase in the money supply and credit, period. Now, typically speaking, if you have more money in circulation, it's going to be chasing existing goods and services and force prices up. So you would normally have higher prices that go with inflation. But if any time you destroy wealth, then that is, by definition, deflationary. I think the trick to understand, though, is this whole edifice, this whole financial system that we've built over the last 90 years since we created the Fed, is all based on debt. So if we go into a major deflation, then people will start to default on their debts, just as United Nations defaulted, just what we're talking about, GM defaulted. And if they default on their debt, then those debt instruments that people hold lose their credibility, and then people want to get out of all debt instruments into something that's tangible and real. And that's why gold and silver will be a refuge from a deflationary collapse.
All right, fine. So, well, but do you think the price of gold and silver could actually drop at this time?
You could see it drop temporarily. In fact, that's what we have going on right now. The markets are trying to deflate. The stock market's trying to go below 10,000. The dollar's trying to drop. But when it does, it's so scary. All the central banks, we discussed this earlier, have to come in to the rescue to prop up the dollar. And then the Fed chairman comes out and acts like he's going to get real tough on inflation by raising interest rates a quarter of a point. And it's all a game, as you say. They're trying to convince the world that they're serious about fighting inflation, and therefore you need to get out of your inflation hedges, and it's all psychological warfare, really. The truth is that they have no choice but to keep the printing press going. You see, raising interest rates a quarter of a point every 2 months or 3 months is not fighting inflation. Fighting inflation is to cut off the money creation and the credit creation, but they're accommodating that, aren't they? Credit just continues to grow at an ever-increasing rate, because if it doesn't, then the whole system will implode on itself. So I think I've already given the saying that the politician is the only person who's, when they're being let out of town to be tarred and feathered, will jump out in front and act like they're leading the parade. So that's all Greenspan's doing. He's given the illusion or the impression that he's fighting inflation and he's leading the stack. In reality, he's having to react to the threat of a deflationary collapse, and so he has to inflate, inflate, inflate.
All right. So you think that we're going to have inflation rather than deflation?
I think we'll inflate. I mean, just take GM. GM, what, with $300 billion worth of indebtedness? By any criteria,
about $290 billion, something like that.
I'm exaggerating again, aren't I? but $300 or $290 billion worth of indebtedness. By any criteria in a free market, GM is bankrupt.
Hold that thought for just a moment. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Ron Brown. And Ron's point is that General Motors has about $290-some billion of indebtedness. In other words, they have bonds out for that amount of money, and they have to, of course, keep rolling those bonds over so they can keep borrowing their money to keep going. They have about $20 billion in cash. Of course, they have factories that are worth a great deal, but those factories in the United States really aren't much good because it's so expensive to produce the cars here with our labor markets. And, of course, it's not simply the labor cost. It is the cost of the health insurance. It's the cost of the pensions. It's the cost of the disability payments and the EPA and all the environmental things and all the things they have to put up with here in the United States. Whereas if they can produce their goods over in China, and I was saying during the break that I really believe that they're setting up large factories over in China with the idea of eventually of shifting their base of production there, which of course will end automobile production in Illinois and Michigan and surrounding environments, Ohio. So I think this is really a very, very a serious problem as far as our country is concerned, because we are actively and intentionally destroying the industrial base of the country. Well, Ron, I had asked you if you'd looked at all about the, on the commodity market, the number of open interest in gold. And certainly one of the highest, there are over 230,000 contracts in gold there. What's your impression? Why are there so much interest in gold when, of course, we don't see the price of gold going up? Ordinarily, we would see interest in gold, going up if the price was going up, but it's not going up that much.
Well, what I think is happening, if anyone has been following the gold market and the silver market for the last 5, 10, 15 years, it's rather obvious that there is a manipulation of the market going on. We've talked about how they manipulate the silver at the night and for the last 2 years. But in the gold market, all these central banks are being forced, and these nations are being forced to support the dollar to keep it from collapsing. And my gut feeling is that a lot of this new demand coming into the gold market, because if you have an open interest, someone had to be buying, that a lot of this open interest is that some of these countries and big investors overseas that are trying to hedge their bets and buy gold to protect themselves from what they're having to do to support the dollar. Now, when they come in to buy gold, everything else being equal, that would force the price up, and the bullion bankers that we've discussed, Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and there's about 8 or 9 of them, their job is to hold the price down, so I think they take the short side of that transaction. So, reality, the open interest hadn't really changed that much. In fact, it had dropped pretty considerably back in December and January. So, you still have a high open interest, and it's when you consider how many dollars that is... It's just a disaster waiting to happen, because every one of those contracts, if you recall and if you know, is an option to take delivery. So take the silver market, for example. There's about 40 million ounces of silver that's in deliverable form on the COMEX, and yet the open interest is running 400 million ounces. So there's much more open interest than there is gold or silver to meet the deliveries if it happens. So at some point we will see what's called a squeeze, where the people demanding delivery will want delivery and there won't be enough gold or silver to meet that delivery.
What's that old adage, that he who sells but isn't his'n has to give it back or go to prison?
Right. But, you know, back to the first question about the inflation. My point with GM is it's so massive that if it were allowed to do what it should do, and that is go bankrupt, then it would, what would it do to the U.S. economy? It would take many other corporations and big investors down with it. So my point is they will have to bail it out. On one of the shows a year or so ago, I facetiously said that if Greenspan called Mr. Bush and said, we need to call a press conference by Wednesday, and by Friday we need to vote in $2 trillion to bail out the pension plans, it would be done. And see, that's maybe overstating the case a little bit, but the point is they cannot allow the system to go into a deflationary implosion. They will do whatever it takes to bail it out.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment. We have Bill calling from Florida. We'll talk to him. But if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for Ron, if you're concerned about what's going on, why, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But, you know, as we analyze what's happening in the monetary markets, in the gold market, the silver market, the stock market, the housing market, it's obvious that this country is spending far more than it's taking in. And as Paul Volcker said, sooner or later, whether a bang or a whimper, there's going to be a major crisis.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we've got Bill calling us from Florida. Hi, Bill. How you been?
Oh, about the same.
Okay, is there anything else? Well, do you have a question for our guest?
I've got two. I'll ask one and then wait for the answer.
All right.
Ron, what do you think is going to happen when the bubble bursts as far as the gold and silver markets? Do you think they'll take off, or do you think they'll drop the price of that?
I think you're about, in fact, I like to look at it from an Elliott Wave perspective. Not that I get caught up in the mathematics of Elliott Wave, but what it does is describe psychologically the market. See, the first leg up in the gold bull market started in July of 2001, and I think we'll look back and say the first wave ended April of 2004. Gold went from 255 up to 455, was ready to break and run to the upside. Silver went from about $4 to got over $8 April a year ago. And then for the last year, we've been in what I call the correction wave, and that's when the powers to be, the people in Washington and Wall Street and at the central bank, they pull out all the stops. They call out all the king's horses and all the king's men, and they desperately try to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. But after a year of propping up the markets and suppressing the gold and silver market, we all can see that Humpty Dumpty is not going back together. The financial aggregates just keep getting worse and worse and worse. So I think we're about to go into the next leg up. And that's when people wake up to the fact that inflation is eating their lunch and they've got to find another way. They can't leave their money invested in CDs or T-bills at 3 or 4%. When they realize inflation is running 8, 10, 12%. So that's when the little people will start to jump on the bandwagon in the gold market, and then it'll just feed on itself. And over the next 2, 3, 4 years, gold and silver should literally explode in price.
Okay. Second question, do you think it's better to invest in silver eagle or gold eagles versus like the 20 Swiss francs or French francs?
I think the 20 francs and all the European coins are highly, highly overrated. They're usually sold by the numismatic dealers, and they try to put up a markup 10, 15, 20% on them, and they sell them as pre-33 coins and therefore non-confiscatable collector coins or whatever. The reality is when you go to resell them in the marketplace, and I've been in this business for 26 years now, you're lucky to get spot for them. So to me, they're not my favorite way. Any form of gold you'll be happy with when gold goes up, but there's better ways to buy it, in my opinion.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Hold that thought. Thanks so much, Bill. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Ron Brown. Ron, let's go ahead and get your telephone number out. And, of course, you do have some sort of brochure that you've written up. I remember reading it here about a year, year and a half ago, and I thought it was really very well crafted, an excellent analysis of what's really happening financially. Have you written anything since then, or are you still with that same product? Well, because, actually, it's as true today as it was when you wrote it.
That's right. You know, I need to update it, and I wish I was a little more prolific as a writer, but I am planning to write another one. But I've put some other stuff together in a package for people. And but if they'd like to call and get a chat with me or get a copy of some information, my number is 1-800-595-0561.
Give that number one more time.
It's 1-800-595-0561.
All right, fine. And, of course, if you're out there in the listening audience, why, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. One of the major problems we face as a nation today is that we have literally no savings. The American people are not saving their money other than what they're investing in their pension funds, which is, of course, done almost involuntarily through their 401k or the KEO plans. But as far as being big savers on their own, if things turn south, they lose their job or something comes along, why, they're going to be in real trouble, and especially now with the new bankruptcy laws. Were you concerned when you saw the them push this through at a federal level, which they never should have done? It's unconstitutional. But it would almost be appear that they understand that there's going to be a major financial crisis, and they're going to be absolutely certain that nobody escapes from this crisis unscathed.
Yeah, to me, it's such an obvious trap. I've been saying for 15, 20 years that the borrower becomes the slave to the lender. I didn't say that, the Bible said that, and that's exactly what's about to happen, because over the last 10, 15, 20 years, as we went into this euphoric inflationary boom, people just got in the habit of overspending and then walking away from their debts, and of course, that's not a very biblical thing to do, but my point is, they made it so easy that people just did it at will. That had to stop, and of course, the federal government uses that excuse to usurp the powers that they shouldn't have. I agree with you on that. But what's happening is that the debt structure is so massive that it's about to implode, and now they're going to crack down and make it almost impossible to declare bankruptcy and walk away from some of those debts. So these people that are really think it can't happen are really setting themselves up for bondage.
You know, so many people, of course, are living off their credit cards, and you know, but what they don't understand is they can increase the actual interest on those credit cards anytime they want to. And this could be just disastrous.
That's right.
Well, let's go to Jeff, who's calling in from Santa Cruz. Hi, Jeff. How are you doing?
Hey, how are you doing? Very good. I'm always impressed with your shows, and Ron Brown, well, it's amazing. And so are you.
Well, I always enjoy having Ron on. So did you have a question for him?
Yeah, well, the one question sort of comment also, maybe you can comment on it, is don't seem to realize, they talk about, oh, well, stocks maybe aren't doing that bad, or they've only gone down this much, and, you know, almost semi-acceptable to them. But they don't take into consideration that the dollar's devalued so much. You know, all these things, even the price of gas. Well, the dollar's going down so much against the euro and whatnot. You know, so the stocks are even doing worse, in other words, than they really think they are.
How would you like to respond to that, Ron?
That's the illusion of inflation that it creates. It creates the illusion of prosperity. I was reading something just this morning. They were saying that 20, 30 years ago, you'd have had enough money to buy a new car. Instead, you would have put that into the stock market. Today, despite the fact that the stock market's going up rather dramatically, you still would barely be able to buy a new car. So you haven't really gotten ahead at all, even though your dollar profits have gone up rather dramatically in this inflationary boom.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Jeff. There's a quotation from Daniel Webster I really value. And he said this: of all the contrivances for cheating the laboring classes of mankind, nothing has been more effective than that which deludes them with paper money.
Right.
Of all the contrivances for cheating the laboring classes of mankind, none has been more effective than that which deludes them with paper money. It's all a delusion. It's all a perception. They are manipulating our minds, and you're absolutely right. I mean, with the value of the dollar going down internationally, the stock market has been falling, but the people can't see that. All they see is what's right before them. And, of course, they believe the government that tells them the inflation rate is only 3%, and they ignore what they see when they go to the gas pump, when they pay their medical bills, when they look at the cost of housing, when they go to the food store. They cannot separate what they see from what the government is telling them, and they honestly believe, since the government says we have an inflation of 2.5 to 3%, that's all it is, and what all it is really a lie.
Right.
Do you have another question for our guest?
Well, just really, what can we do? I mean, what does he think? I mean, it seems like getting rid of the Fed is the ultimate, you know, that's sort of like the cure-all. It doesn't seem like that's ever going to happen.
All right, Ron, what can be done? First of all, what can the individual do? And then what should we do collectively?
Well, individually, we have to just recognize that this whole thing is a financial bubble, and that's the hardest thing. Like you said, people inside the bubble can't see it. But if they don't, if they maintain the same course that they've been on for the last 10, 20 years, their savings will get wiped out because we are going into an inflationary, they will inflate until the dollar is rejected worldwide, and then it'll become massive deflation because the dollar is no longer money. So anyone that has their savings in bonds or CDs or T-bills or, you know, checking account, it's just the treadmill is going faster. In fact, it's going faster and faster all the time compared to what they're earning on interest. So they're losing purchasing power daily now. So you're going to have to just get out of paper assets and look to the refuge of gold and silver, which has served mankind throughout all history. It's biblical money. It's historical money. It's real money. And so whenever the world loses confidence in the paper money of the day, and it's happened hundreds of thousands of times, gold and silver is always the refuge. So that's the really only hope that I can see of trying to protect yourself.
Well, one of my producer has asked the question, what types of gold and silver do you recommend?
I recommend bullion-type coins. My favorite to start with is the little 1/10-ounce gold eagle, or any of the 1/10-ounce coins will be fine, because, you know, if we're talking $2,000, $3,000 gold, which I think we're talking, one-ounce coin becomes a lot of money. So the little 10-ounces become very, very popular in times when people perceive a coming crisis. Back in 99, when we were looking forward to the Y2K, the little 10-ounce gold eagles went from $32 my cost on January the 5th, and 2 weeks later they were $49 my cost. In other words, they jumped 50% in the price when the price of gold had not even budged. So I think the little 10-ounce coins, get some 1-ounce gold coins. And then if you have more money to put in, then you can buy some $20 gold pieces. Just be careful and make sure you buy them right and you don't pay these ridiculous markups that some of the dealers charge.
That's a fact.
Okay, anything else, Jeff?
I guess it was Voltaire who said, sooner or later, paper money returns to its intrinsic value, zero. I agree. And also the thing about the gold American denominations is, let's say it's a $5 coin, then, you know, you can still carry a lot of them and be under the $10,000 limit.
That's right.
Hey, but anyways, I really appreciate your shows. Yeah, and as you say, that's the ultimate cheating is this paper money, and people have to wake up. The emperor has no clothes.
Now, there's a fascinating article in the Encyclopedia Americana. This is what it says. This is a page. This is the volume 19, 1966 edition. It is the indisputable lesson of history that sooner or later, and usually sooner, all paper money declines in quality. Representative money becomes credit money. Credit money becomes fiat money. And fiat money becomes the epitome of worthlessness. So there's nothing really new under the sun. Hey, thanks for calling, Jeff.
All right. Hey, well, thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, and we have another caller on the line, and it looks like we've got Eric from Compton. Hi, Eric. How are you doing?
Fine, Doc. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, Mr. Brown. How are you?
Just fine.
I've talked to you on many occasions. I have a question. There's some type of advantage to investing in gold and silver outside of California. I forgot what that was. Can you explain that to me?
Well, I don't.
Is there some kind of extra tax?
I don't know about that, Eric. I've never heard that.
I thought there was some kind of tax or penalty. Let's say I want to buy gold and invest in California as opposed to outside of California. I thought there was some extra fine.
Well, some cities will charge a sales tax or something on it. I don't know which cities that would apply to in California. Of course, I operate and have a lot of clients in California, but I'm operating outside, so I'm not aware of which cities would be doing that.
Eric, I really don't know of that, because I've certainly purchased some gold and silver here in California from various places, and I've never run into that. Maybe there's something you could look up and let us know, but I'm really not acquainted with that at all.
Okay, well, I guess, I thought I heard something. I wasn't sure.
Well, there are a lot of rumors out there, a lot of organized confusion. So, you can't believe anything here, except unless you hear it on Radio Liberty, of course. And then,
of course.
And then, of course, check it as well. We always try to do the right thing by you. Any other questions?
That'll be it.
All right.
God bless you guys.
Much. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 right here at Radio Liberty. And our guest is Ron Brown. We're simply talking about what is happening financially as far as our country. And, of course, there is no instance in all history where a nation has gone onto a fiat money system where that has not eventually collapsed. And when you hear people like certainly Paul Volcker talking to my friend Joan Vian about a year ago at a meeting of the central bankers, I think it was over in Basel, Switzerland, at the Bank of International Settlement meeting, and she asked him, what about the monetary system? And he said, we didn't do a very good job. We're going to have to come up with another one. So they have another plan. But you can be sure it's not going to be beneficial for us. I think it's exactly as Ron was saying earlier, and that is that all we need is another financial crisis, and we're going to bring on the new world order. And with that, the loss of freedom, the loss of sovereignty, the loss of our physical possessions, and, well, I fear the loss of our lives, the people are going to have to begin to make preparations physically, and they're going to have to make preparations spiritually, I really believe, for the difficult times that lie ahead. How would you respond to that statement, Ron?
Well, even a lot of the people that are involved in the conservative movement, our whole society has gotten so caught up with materialism and making money, and, people come in to buy gold and silver like that's going to be their protection, and that's going to make them get rich off of the crisis. And I said, you need to put a certain amount of your wealth in gold and silver and pray it's the worst investment you ever made, because if the silver goes through the roof, then we're going to have problems in America that their gold and silver won't solve. So our problem really is a spiritual problem, and America as we know it, the America we have taken for granted for all of our lives that gives us that freedom, is really in jeopardy. Yet most of us, even when we are aware of what's happening, we're not thinking in terms of how do we save the system, or even preparing for it spiritually, because that really is the only hope.
And I agree with you totally, and I think it's really amazing that the average American has never thought of what would happen if the whole system collapsed. They cannot imagine that the same thing could happen here that happened in Argentina just 3 or 4 years ago, but it's happened so many times in the countries of South America. It happened certainly during the Clinton administration in Mexico, just across the border, when their whole financial system literally collapsed. I can remember back in the early 1980s when my doctor friends were investing in Mexico, they were getting 25% interest on their money. Boy, that's just really great. But of course, before they ever got the money out, the whole system fell apart.
Right.
And when you're getting interest like that, it means the investment just isn't safe. This is what it's really all about. That's why, of course, they're going to get 13.5% for GM bonds, because people aren't going to buy those bonds unless they get a tremendous interest rate, because there is a very real possibility that down the line, General Motors and Ford are going to default on their debts. And when that happens, why, heaven help America.
And what's even scarier, when you talk about these nations in South America and so forth collapsing, there was always America to come in and to help bail them out. So the pain was limited somewhat. But if the U.S. goes under and the world's reserve currency goes down the tank, then what's going to bail us out, So it's frightening to think where this thing could lead when this whole bubble starts to implode on itself.
And, of course, my fear is that if this thing starts to implode, it will spread throughout the entire world, because the entire world is dependent today on the United States as the ultimate consumer. In other words, we're buying the vast majority of the products that are being created throughout the rest of the world. In other words, we are supporting the economy of the rest of the world, and in the process, of course, we're exporting our wealth to finance that. But what happens if America is no longer able to buy all the things that China's producing, and that are being produced in Cambodia, that are being produced in Vietnam, that are being produced in Honduras? What's going to happen to their economies?
Well, exactly, and that's why all the central banks of the world are so desperate to hold the dollar and keep it from collapsing overnight, so this thing doesn't go down a black hole. I was reading Ken Gerbino this morning, and he follows 61 different nations, and on average, their money supply has increased 15% over the last 12 months. So we're forcing this inflation on the rest of the world as well, so the whole world has become an inflationary bubble.
Yeah, but of course, could there be worldwide deflation? Is that a possibility? If America gets to a situation where they can't buy, that how are all these other nations going to be able to sell their products?
Well, the ultimate end game will be a deflationary implosion when all paper money just loses value.
That's what happened in the Civil War
when the Confederate money became worthless.
Well, we're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program with Ron Brown and welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and what were you saying about was that during the Civil War, the Confederacy, or what?
Well, remember the Confederate dollars, they just created them at will, and then the Confederate dollar lost its credibility. And when it no longer became money, then the whole Confederate system was in a massive deflation because there was no money. That's what will happen to the dollar. See, as long as people will accept the dollar, then they will keep the inflation game going. But at some point, the creditors will say no more. Your dollars are becoming worthless and we don't want them. And at that point, we go into a massive deflation. So they will inflate until the system collapses.
And of course, is this what Paul Volcker, you think, was referring to when he was saying that at a certain point, foreign banks, central banks, are going to say we've had enough of the dollar, and at that point, the game is over? Was that? Do you think he was referring to?
I think that's exactly what he's referring to. You know, he has to come out and say, "I told you so," even though he's been part of the system that kept inflation going, and this whole fractional reserve banking system, you know, all of them go the same way. It goes into a hyperinflation and the whole system collapses. And then, of course, the powers that created that use the collapse for their own agenda, and that is to consolidate more power.
And I would simply suggest that if you can go to the Internet and look up Paul Volcker, April 10th, Washington Post. Get that article and read it. If you can't get it, of course, give us a call. We'll send it to you. But I have to ask not only what he's saying, but why he's saying it. Why is he telling us what I think is exactly what's going to happen? And I think that we should be very concerned. We've got Bernice calling from Michigan. Hi, Bernice. Do you have a quick question for our guest?
Yes, I do. I have young sons. They're like 22 and 24. And they are so full. You know, I'm a Christian, and I listen to all this, and I believe it. You know, I know you're telling the truth. But when I tell my children, you know, with Social Security, how they're wanting them to put their savings into stocks, how in the world do I convince them it's true that they're not getting fooled by Christians and they believe the world and they're going to go broke? They ain't going to have a thing, of course. None of us are, but... And I keep getting these things in the mail wanting me to borrow money on my home, you know.
Don't you dare do that.
I'm not. I throw them in the garbage.
Good for you. The young people think that they can play the system. They don't understand. The system is set up like this. We win, you lose. That's the way it's set up. So try to counsel them. But, you know, parents, it takes a long time before children learn how smart their parents really are.
Yes. But what kind of book study could I get, Dr. Stan?
Hold that thought. Okay. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Bernice, did you have a question for him?
Yes, what in the world do we do to convince our children, our young ones?
Will they read at all? Will they watch a video?
Yes, oh yes, they'll read.
Well, what book would you suggest that they might get to try to educate them what's going on?
Uh, to me, a good primer is The Creature of Jekyll Island. I'm sure you've got a lot of books in your library, Dr. Stan. But
well, I think this is probably the single best primer. We do carry the book, Bernice, The Creature from Jekyll Island. We also carry a very short book written by Professor Sutton, who was a personal friend before he passed away, called The Federal Reserve Conspiracy. Either one of those books would be excellent. And then if you could get them to read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, and or watch the video, I think it would help them to understand the spiritual component of what's going on, because you can't understand anything that's going on financially or politically or culturally or ideologically unless you understand the spiritual forces that are energizing this whole incredible movement.
Yes, and I have one son that's 41. He's a doctor, and he invests in stock, and I keep telling him, buy gold, buy silver, and they think I'm nuts.
Well, I'll tell you what, when this whole thing is collapses, and it's going to collapse sooner or later, no matter how smart you are, why, you can't fight the system when the whole thing collapses. So pray for him, Bernice. That's all we can suggest. If you get him to listen to our programs or read those things we suggested, maybe they'd begin to understand what this is about. Why don't you try to get him to read The Brotherhood of Darkness? Because that may very well introduce them to what's going on.
Okay, I will. If they'll read Dan Brown, they'll read you.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bernice, if you'll call me tomorrow, I'll put together a package of information that you can get to the...
Okay,
why don't you get that telephone number on one more time then, Ron?
That's 1-800-595-0561. 1-800-595-0561.
And it's really very good information. I was quite impressed by it. God bless. Thanks so much,
Bernice. God bless you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. That was Bernice calling from Michigan. And, well, Ron, I guess we're out of time. I want to thank you so very much for being with us. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners?
I don't know what's, you know, people just have got to wake up to, they've got to see the danger ahead of them and start preparing for it. And, you know, if they can't see it now, it scares me because it's so obvious that what's happening. I don't know what else to say.
Anyway, God bless you. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you again next month.
Okay.
Bye-bye. And that's Ron Brown here this evening. And, of course, we do suggest the books, The Creature from Jekyll Island, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, The Fiat Money Inflation in France, Dr. Sutton's book, Professor Sutton's book, I should say, Gold for Investment, his other book, Gold for Survival, and an excellent video. It's called Phenomenon. So again, that's Creature from Jekyll Island, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, Gold for Investment, and another book, Gold for Survival, and then Fiat Money and Inflation in France, and the video, Phenomenon, the Monopoly Men. And here you'll actually see Milton Friedman talking about how the Great Depression of 1929 was actually created by a Federal Reserve System. They did it intentionally, of course, to contract the money supply and impoverish our people. And the rich get richer, and the poor get poor. So our telephone number, if you'd like to get a free copy of some of our newsletters on this subject, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to, of course, get my newsletters on this subject, I think it's August, September, and October of 2004. Go to the internet site at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. Pull down the August, September, and October 2004 newsletters. We have a new DVD out. It's called The Financial Crisis. You just asked for it. It's a DVD on the financial crisis talk we gave last week. And then Pray for America, Pray for Revival. But please pray for Radio Liberty. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.